So as always, let's start with a short meditation. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. All the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. Allowing your entire body to become completely relaxed. Completely at ease. Relaxing more deeply with every out-breath. Allowing the breath to flow naturally, effortlessly. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. Simply allow the mind to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Find that you're becoming distracted, then use the out-breath as an opportunity to relax, release the distraction, and then very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return. Or if you find that you're becoming dull or spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse, refresh, sharpen your focus on the breath. So to help balance the mind, to help overcome dullness and distraction, then on each out-breath, we can relax and release any distractions, and on each in-breath, refresh our focus on the breath. Now release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply rest within awareness itself. Without really trying to do anything at all. Just be. Just rest within luminously clear awareness. All sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance, and simply rest in pristine, pure awareness. Then relax completely, releasing your awareness into space in all directions. Taking nothing as an object. Completely relaxing and releasing. Completely open and spacious. And then withdraw your awareness right in upon itself, right into the present moment, right into luminously clear awareness, completely alert. And once again, release your awareness into space in all directions. Completely relax, releasing all appearances. And once again, invert your awareness right in upon itself, right into luminously clear awareness. Completely alert. And then just rest. Simply rest in luminously clear awareness. Relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. And maintaining that open, spacious state, we can slowly end the meditation and begin our discussions again together today. So again, we can use the root text in the front of your booklet here to do a little review of the points that we've covered so far. So within this 7-point mind training, one of the main texts used within the Lojong system of practice, then we've looked at the first point, the presentation of preliminaries, the basis, meaning what foundation practices that we need to engage in to have a good basis for the two main practices of wisdom and compassion. And then we looked at the second of the 7 points, which is the main practice, of course, wisdom and compassion. And here, Lojong is within the Mahayana vehicle, meaning that the wisdom wing of practice is the wisdom of emptiness. Compassion wing is the mind of bodhicitta. So within the wisdom practice, we had a look at what to do within meditation and what to do to continue to cultivate this wisdom practice in daily life. And so in meditation, we are practicing often what's called space-like emptiness, coming to realize that phenomena, the world, ourself, our mind, our body, is empty of independent existence. This is a space-like experience. And then to continue to cultivate that wisdom of emptiness in daily life with what's often called illusory-like emptiness practice, where we are to investigate appearances and come to realize that things are not existing and they appear as they appear, thereby helping us to avoid reacting to pleasant and unpleasant situations with attachment and aversion, and also strengthening our understanding of emptiness, strengthening our understanding that everything is a dependent arising. And then, of course, in the other main practice, the compassion side, the mind of bodhicitta, here in Lojong, we are using the exchanging self with others approach. So the main meditative practice here, of course, is the tonglen, the giving and taking, imagining taking on the suffering of others and giving our happiness away to them, and thereby exchanging or replacing our current self-cherishing attitude with an attitude of cherishing others. Replacing our current attachments and aversions to others to loving kindness and compassion for others. And then in daily life, we are to also continue to cultivate this practice in terms of when any mental afflictions arise in our mind, instead of getting caught up in them, to use the tonglen approach to take on those afflictions from others and give them the loving kindness and compassion instead to reduce and eliminate our mental afflictions. But also we can use the same approach with our own suffering or when we see others having mental afflictions or sufferings as well. We can use the tonglen approach instead of reacting to our own suffering or mental afflictions or reacting to others' sufferings or mental afflictions, we can use this practice to not react rather than use these situations to cultivate loving kindness and compassion and exchange self with others. Then the third of the 7 points, we looked at taking adverse conditions into the path, meaning to see difficult situations not as problems but as opportunities. And again, we can do that with both the wisdom side of the practice and the compassion side of the practice. So the main key point here, of course, is to not get caught up in hope and fear, expectation and apprehension. Meaning now we tend to have a lot of hope in terms of hoping for pleasant experiences. We have a lot of fear and worry about potential unpleasant experiences. So long as we are trapped in this cycle of hoping for good things, fearing and worrying about unpleasant things, We're never going to be able to take adverse conditions into the path. We're always going to see these difficult situations as problems, as obstacles, and induce a lot of unnecessary extra suffering on ourselves. So here, part of this, to overcome this, is to really understand who or what is our friend and who or what is our enemy. Again, when we're trapped in the hope-fear cycle, we tend to feel as if the enemy is those people and things out there that seem to be the source of our suffering. And our friend seems to be this self-cherishing mind, seeming to bring us happiness. But here it's suggesting that if we look closely, we can see that it's exactly the opposite, meaning that our worst enemy is our self-cherishing mind. And others are our friends, even those who try to harm us. So if we can see things in this way, then we can use these difficult situations in our practice difficult situations to take them into our practice, and we can again use at the compassion level, then when we are faced with suffering or someone's trying to harm us, we can use that to strengthen our loving kindness and compassion through the Tonglen approach. Also from the wisdom side, then whatever appearances arise, even if they are unpleasant things that are appearing to us, we can use all of these appearances to remind us that things are not existing as they appear, and thereby we can use these appearances to increase our understanding of emptiness, and thereby not react to these adverse appearances with aversion, hostility, anger, and hatred. So we can use all these appearances then as reminders of how things exist, and thereby increase our wisdom practice. And then also part of this taking adverse conditions into the path was to practice the accumulation and purification. That when we see suffering and difficult situations, they are reminders to us that suffering comes from negative actions, happiness comes from positive actions. And thereby we can use these difficult situations as a reminder for us to engage in virtue and to purify any negative actions that we've been engaging in. So this is how to take adverse conditions into the path. And then the fourth of the 7 points is we looked at how to synthesize all of these practices into an effective daily life practice. And here we saw that there are 5 core elements that if we focus on, we can make an effective daily life practice. And so here, the first of those was propelling intention, meaning in the morning we can have the intention to cultivate wisdom and compassion throughout the day, throughout the week, month, the rest of our life. So we can propel our day in this way. And then, of course, acquaintance means to uninterruptedly cultivate these 2 aspects of wisdom and compassion throughout all of our activities in meditation and also our daily life behavior. To support that, we had the 3rd and 4th power, the power of the positive seed, to engage in virtue in general. The 4th one, eradication, means to, whenever we notice self-grasping, self-cherishing coming up in our daily life, to eradicate, to let go of self-grasping, self-cherishing as much as we can. Then, at the end of each virtuous activity, at the end of the day, this aspirational prayer, this dedication to aspire to continue to cultivate wisdom and compassion in our life, and also to aspire to meet teachers to help us to practice these 2 aspects. So if we can engage in these 5 core elements, then we can have a very effective daily life practice. Also, at the time of death, as we're approaching death, we can use these very same 5 powers to help us through the death process, through that transition. Here they're in a slightly different order and some of them have slightly different meaning. Here we saw that the first of the 5 powers was the positive seed. And here it meant that as we're approaching death is to let go of attachment. Let go of attachment to our material things, to give them away. Let go of attachment to friends and let go of attachment to the body. Because any of these attachments are just going to create a lot of fear and anxiety as we're approaching death. If we can let go of these attachments, we can be more fearless in the face of death. Then the second, of course, aspirational prayer, again, is to aspire to continue to practice wisdom and compassion and to meet teachers in our future lives. And then as we are going to go through the death process is, again, to have eradication, meaning to let go of self-grasping, self-cherishing as much as we can, and then to have the propelling intention to not be separated from wisdom and compassion throughout the death process. And then acquaintance, of course, is to then uninterruptedly cultivate wisdom and compassion through the death process, to alternate backwards and forwards between Tong Len, taking on the suffering of the world, giving out happiness, and resting in that emptiness experience, alternating these as we are going through the process. So these were the four, this was the fourth of the 7 points. Then the fifth point was the measure of having trained the mind. How can we understand if our mind training is progressing and is being effective? So we had a few points here. The first, of course, was that mind training practice, Lojong practice, we should notice that our self-grasping, self-cherishing mind is reducing. If it's not, then our practice is not progressing, is not being very effective. And we need to monitor that through our honestly by our through ourselves, and then also we can get some advice and guidance from qualified teachers about that as well. And one other effective way to notice if our practice is progressing is what is happening to our mind when we are faced with difficult situations. Are we continuing to react with agitation, irritation, hostility, anger, and hatred? Or are we starting to see difficult situations as opportunities and not reacting, but trying to use these difficult situations to cultivate wisdom and compassion? So this is another way in which we can see if our practice is progressing. And then we've moved on to the sixth point now, the presentation of the commitments of mind training. And the seventh point, which we're going to cover today as well, is the precepts of mind training. So the difference between these two is that the commitments of mind training are a list of things which help us to show what sorts of things go against mind training, what violates mind training, to things that we need to avoid to stop going against our practice. And so here we see most of these in this list are in the negative. Do not do this, do not do that. Meaning these are things that we are to avoid to go against mind training. So that's commitments, whereas precepts is more about what sorts of things we need to engage in to support and nurture our practice. And so that's what we're going to be looking at a little bit later this morning. So we've covered a few of the points in the sixth one, the commitments. So just to briefly go through the few points we've covered so far yesterday afternoon. The first was to train constantly in the three general points. And they were, the first was not to contradict our ethical basis if we've taken some vows or pledges in terms of ethical guidelines, not to go against that. The second one is not to think that if we're doing mind training that we are impervious to harm and thereby put ourselves unnecessarily in dangerous situations. And third one is to not be biased, meaning to apply mind training to all situations, to all people, and not just to some situations and to some people. Then the second one was to transform your attitudes but remain as you are, meaning here, of course, Lojong is talking about transforming our mind. It's not talking about making some big outward display. If we do that, it's a sure sign that our ego has got hold of our practice and now we're just becoming a spiritual ego and we're getting caught up in the 8 worldly concerns. And then the next two, do not speak of defects of others, do not reflect on others' shortcomings. Again, we can easily understand that if we do this, then we are not practicing wisdom and compassion. We are simply, again, criticizing others. And this comes also from cognitive fusion. So this is a sure sign that we have gone against our practice of wisdom and compassion. The next point was discard all expectations of reward. So again, here, expectations is a sign we are still trapped in the hope-fear cycle. We have hope of achieving something. We have some clinging, grasping attachment to some sort of experience or result. And these expectations are just going to lead us to a lot of unnecessary frustration in our practice. So if we notice any sorts of expectations, we need to let go of those and simply understand what the goal is, how to achieve that goal, and then to the best of our ability, work in the present moment to work towards that goal. And then the last point we looked at yesterday was discard poisonous food. So of course here, the poisonous food is self-grasping, self-cherishing. So if we are taking this poisonous food of self-grasping, self-cherishing, again, this is a sure sign that our ego has hijacked our practice and we're just becoming a spiritual ego. So we need to consume that poisonous food of self-grasping, self-cherishing, is to get rid of it, let go of it, overcome it as best we can. So that's where we left off. So let's continue on from there. So let's go into the commentary now. So we are on page 120 in the middle. And the next slogan is to do not maintain inappropriate loyalty. Actually, this, the way it's written in the Tibetan, is quite difficult to understand. And so there are a couple of different interpretations of what this slogan means. One here in the commentary says, this means you should not refrain from expressing condemnation out of disapproval of unjust acts committed by the other. So what this is saying is to not tolerate others' bad behavior, but also not to tolerate our own mental afflictions. But here, of course, we are to avoid cognitive fusion, because if we do cognitive fusion, then instead of not accepting others' bad behavior, we will simply attack the person with anger. So here, of course, and of course, if we do the same with ourselves, we will simply beat ourselves up for our mental afflictions. So we need to make sure that we don't do that. Rather, if someone is behaving badly, use compassion to help them overcome that negative behavior. Or if we are behaving badly or have mental afflictions, then use compassion for ourselves to overcome that negative behavior or mental affliction. So this is one way of interpreting this slogan. And I'd just like to read a little bit more about this slogan from, the practice of Lojong from Tralok Gapgon. This is on page 181. And he says, another traditional interpretation of this slogan advises us not to be too accepting of our own shortcomings or too tolerant of what is harmful. Normally, we don't know what to tolerate and what to condemn, enduring all kinds of unpleasant experiences without complaint. This slogan points out that relying on and becoming too comfortable with such unwholesome mental states will have an insidious and corroding effect on our character, and we must do everything in our power to avoid being duped in this way. Another interpretation of this slogan refers to the many forms of ill will we are prone toward, because we often mistake our own selfish thoughts and motivations for our allies. We need to be clear that just because someone has a friendly appearance does not necessarily mean they are trustworthy. We have to exercise caution with our emotional responses. learning not only to recognize destructive and insidious responses such as resentment, vengeance, and anger, but allowing ourselves to be repelled by the seductions that they invite. Even if they seem at first to provide us with protective armor, they will only lead to our downfall, making us more vulnerable than ever. That's why Aryadeva can say, so this is quoting Aryadeva, who was one of the main disciples of Nagarjuna, great Indian master from the 2nd century. And Aryadeva said, "Desire is no friend, but seems like one, which is why you do not fear it. But shouldn't people particularly rid themselves of a harmful friend?" Mind training practice is not about simply learning to be accommodating. Sometimes people get the idea that only our samsaric mind rejects things and that our problems would be solved if we could learn to be more open and responsive. The emphasis here is on skillful means, not simply on working with every situation in an accepting way. Whether we tolerate a situation or not isn't the problem. It's whether we recognize what is beneficial for us and what is only going to be harmful. If we examine ourselves more closely, we may find that blindly showing good-naturedness is one of our most problematic impulses. So I think that's also some quite good advice on that point. Now, with all of these that are coming in this section and the next, I think they're fairly straightforward. So what I'm going to do is simply read the commentary, make a few more comments perhaps, and then maybe refer to one of the two Lojong books, and then I'll just keep going. And so at the end of each one, if you have any questions, then raise your hand. Otherwise, I'll simply move on to the next one. Okay? So what I'll do again is I'll read the slogan, read the commentary, maybe a couple of comments, and maybe something from one of the two books, and then if you have questions, then that's the time. Otherwise, I'll just keep going. So, any questions on this point before I move on? Yeah.
It sounds like you're saying not only to be gentle and kind to others.
No, it's saying not to be, it says that not to maintain inappropriate loyalty, which means to not be loyal to our own mental afflictions or others' bad behavior. I mean, not just sort of sit there and accept it. Remember, with cognitive fusion, if someone's behaving badly, then we tend to do one of two things. I mean, in any situation, we can only accept or reject. But if we do cognitive fusion and someone's behaving badly, the one we do, of course, is reject. I mean, it's their bad behavior we don't like, but if we see them as a bad person, then, of course, we end up attacking the person. We get hostile, anger, hatred toward the person. The only other option left, if we don't do that, is to accept the situation, which means that if we've done the cognitive fusion, we accept their bad behavior. I think this is what it's talking about here. The inappropriate loyalty would be to be friendly or loyal to others' bad behavior or our own bad behavior or others' mental afflictions or our own mental afflictions, is to not tolerate that. But again, if we do cognitive fusion, to not tolerate that means we just flip to the other extreme of attacking the person. So to be effective in this, we need to avoid cognitive fusion, to distinguish ourselves from our behavior, others from their behavior. And then if others are behaving badly, we're behaving badly, we cannot maintain inappropriate loyalty, which means we can address that behavior without attacking the person or attacking ourselves. I think this is what it's saying. Well, because others' faults is one of the two. It's the opposite of this. It's we do cognitive fusion and we attack the person. You know, we criticize the person and condemn the person. So these are, with cognitive fusion, these are the two options. You know, attacking other people, condemning other people, or maintaining inappropriate loyalty. So these are the two extreme behaviors that we need to let go of. Okay, let's move to the next one. Do not torment with malicious banter. So again, this is another classic example of cognitive fusion. Whatever task befall you, Do not engage in malicious jokes that tear at others' hearts or cause them to lose their composure. Regardless of their culpability, avoid insulting and speaking harshly to others, whether close, distant, good or bad. So I think, again, this is fairly obvious, is that, you know, if we think someone's behaving badly, then, you know, we engage in this sort of behavior because we see them as a bad person and we criticize them and insult them and speak harshly to them. So then let's go to the next one. Do not lie in ambush. So again, another example of cognitive fusion, meaning if someone's behaved badly, particularly towards us, we see them as a bad person, we often do this, it says what not to do is, do not harbor vengeance for a wrong done to you, waiting for an opportune moment to retaliate. So again, this is another example of seeing that person as a bad, evil person, and they deserve to be punished, and we need to punish them. So let's think of a way we can punish them, and let's wait for that opportunity. So that's what it means to lie in ambush. And here then, there's some very nice commentary, very helpful advice from Alan Wallace. So I'll read that. It's on page 250. And he says, this is a common Tibetan idiom with deep meaning. Tibetan Buddhist medicine describes the differences in temperament among people as being related to their individual humoral constitutions, of which there are three: wind, bile, and phlegm. So these are three different types of, and I think this also comes in other traditional medicines. You know, there's these three types of people who are prone to be more wind character, more bile, or more phlegm type person. It says here, waiting in ambush is a behavior typical of people with a phlegmatic constitution. He says, windy people tend to speak quickly, be hyperactive, fun-loving, and sociable. Annoy a windy person and he will probably snap at you right away and then forget about it. So maybe there's some windy people. Bile people tend to be sharp-witted and sharp-tempered. Insult a person with a bile temperament and he too may react quickly and vehemently. Phlegmatic people tend to be forbearing and can endure pain and grief that would cause other types of people to cave in. They may take insult after insult without any overt reaction, but they are especially prone to, quote, wait in ambush, quietly plotting their moment of revenge. This pledge is couched in the idiom of Tibet, where waiting in ambush was a finely honed skill. So again, this also, again, is a classic example of cognitive fusion. Someone has done something harmful, particularly to us, so we see them as a bad, nasty, evil person. They deserve to be punished. I'm going to do that. I'm going to wait to an opportune moment to punish them. So again, this is not going to solve anything. It's probably just going to make that person worse, because they will react to that. And in fact, it's the same idea here in our modern day judicial system, that often in many of our judicial systems, when people have done a crime, then instead of punishing the crime, we punish the person. And so we often in our judicial system, we say, you're guilty. And then we put them in jail. And then often in our jail systems, we punish the person. We're very harsh on the person in the jail. And their statistics show that often they end up worse, so they re-offend. So of course, if someone's behaving negatively, the desired outcome is we would like them to stop doing that. But if we punish them, then statistics show they're more likely to continue to do that. So that's not a very good strategy. So rather than punishing the person, we need to punish the crime. meaning we need to take them out of society. So yes, we need some sort of trial system and some sort of penal system. But instead of punishing the person in the jail, we try to help the person, rehabilitate the person. And statistics show in some modern countries that are trying to adopt this approach in jail systems, instead of punishing the person to rehabilitate the person, statistics show that they generally come out better when they come out of jail. So this is going to be a much better result, because if we do the other, we punish people, then we're, our society is getting worse. They reoffend, and a huge cost to the society. So I think this is a little bit here. We need to try to help people to overcome their negative behaviour. Of course, if they're a danger to society, we need to take them out of society to do that. So we definitely need some sort of judicial system for that. But as long as that is directed at punishing people, I think it's not going to produce the desired result. Rather, we need to punish the crime and help the person rehabilitate as best we can. Of course, sometimes that's difficult, if not impossible, but at least that's a better option than punishing the person, because definitely punishing the people will probably end up with a worse result in the end. Right, let's move to the next point, down the bottom. Do not strike at the heart. Again, I think this is fairly obvious. It says, both toward humans and non-humans, avoid delving into their weak points. With non-humans, for instance, you should avoid uttering fierce, life-extracting mantras. And in the case of humans, you should avoid unearthing, for instance, their moral lapses in situations where many people are around. So again, this is a sign. You know, if someone is behaving badly or has some negative behavior, then often when we do this, you know, maybe we're speaking the truth. But where the motivation for doing this in public is to humiliate the person, not to help the person. So again, this is not a good thing to do. Of course, if someone has got unethical behavior, then with a appropriate motivation of compassion, we can highlight to them maybe in private that this is not acceptable behavior, it's harmful behavior, and try and help the person. But to, in public, try to humiliate them, of course, is not very helpful for that purpose, for that reason. So, again, I think this is a fairly obvious point here. Then we have a nice little Tibetan saying in the next one. Do not place the load of a zo on an ox. A zo is a animal that's a cross between a cow and a yak. And it's a very strong animal. Used usually for carrying heavy weights, heavy loads, whereas an ox or a cow doesn't have that. So here, to place the load of a zo on an ox, as we see from the commentary, it says, avoid such negative behavior as attempting by devious means to shift blame and liability onto others that would otherwise fall onto you. It has that meaning, but also it means to put things onto others who you know can't cope with it. And the reason you do that is you want to see them fail or collapse. So that's also the other meaning. And again, I'll read from Alan Wallace here about that on page 250. A zo is a cross between a yak and an ox, and is considerably stronger than an ox. The meaning here is, don't shift the burden of any task or responsibility onto the shoulders of those who can't bear it. Because often we do that because we want them to fail. We want to see them suffer. And so this is what this saying is saying here. So it has those two meanings, is not to shift the blame onto others, which actually, you know, what's the expression in English? Don't pass the buck. You know, if we don't try and blame others for things that we have done wrongly, and also don't try to put things onto others where we know they can't bear it, and we want, and we're doing that, of course, because we want to see them fail and suffer. So I think this is the meaning here in this slogan. Then we'll move on to the next one. It says, do not sprint to win a race. Avoid such behavior as attempting through unbecoming conduct and other means to transfer the ownership of commonly owned desired objects to yourself. You should not be in a state of craving when you die, and since the other shore comes into being as a result of karma anyway, it is far more joyful instead to let go with a sense of ease, the master said. So I think this commentary here is not very clear, so to make that a little bit more clear, I'll read what is said here in the practice of Lojong about this, do not sprint to win a race. Human beings are by nature competitive and constantly wanting to outperform other people. It really doesn't matter what we are doing. We always act as if we are in some kind of a race, which must have a winner and a loser. This slogan is a reminder that this fixation on winning, outperforming and outsmarting everyone else is a very harmful distraction. It only engenders pride and arrogance when we do a little better than someone else, and gives rise to resentment, envy and jealousy when we perform a little worse. This slogan is not saying that we shouldn't try to excel at things we do, for that would be contrary to the Mahayana vision. It's only suggesting we can excel without having to compete with others. What's the English expression? It's not matter whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. So I think that's what's being said here. We can attain excellence by ourselves simply by doing something to the best of our ability. Even when we're performing in an actual race, we can run that race without thinking we have to be the fastest. If you can manage to be the fastest, that's all well and good, but you shouldn't enter the race with that expectation. And now he's quoting a modern-day master, Tibetan master, Jamyang Kongtrul. He says, in a horse race, the aim is to be the fastest. Among Dharma people, there are often hopes of receiving more attention or being more highly regarded than others, and little schemes are made up to find ways to acquire possessions. Give these up. And then back to the commentary. Many people actually describe their lives as some kind of race, with some people getting farther ahead and others getting left behind. From the Lojong perspective, the samsaric idea that we have to compete with others to gain ground is completely erroneous. We only obsess over winning because of the elation we experience when we have gained superiority over others and we see someone else losing. This is only an illusory victory, fabricated by the samsaric mind, and will experience many obstacles if we continue to see things this way. There will always be people who are richer, more attractive, and more intelligent than we are, with many other qualities besides, and will always feel like a failure in relation to them, no matter what kind of victories we have. In any case, today's winner is yesterday's loser. Life isn't a race, and there don't have to be any winners and losers, nor do we need to see someone else lagging behind in order to feel good about ourselves. This preoccupation with competition is a form of self-deception. We need to think more about what we're doing in relation to ourselves if we want to excel. The Mahayana teachings advise us to compete with our own previous selves. Using our past successes and failures as the measure of our progress in overcoming old constraints, fears, suspicions, and self-doubts. Reinventing ourselves in this way is in complete accord with the Mahayana teachings on self-transformation. If we're too competitive, our lives will become a never-ending battle where we squander our energies trying to outperform others. There can be no real victory in this approach. If we think in terms of excellence, on the other hand, we can achieve constant victory. This Lojong commitment to non-competitiveness is about doing our best for our own sake, rather than as a way of competing with others. We vow to renounce our need to compare ourselves with others or achieve any kind of worldly victories, and simply concentrate on performing our everyday activities and Lojong practice to the best of our ability. So I think that's some very good advice there. Okay, I'll just keep going. So again, any questions, put your hand up. Yeah.
This explanation is given the commentary.
Sorry, I didn't catch. What did you say, sorry?
What I'm saying is that this explanation which has just been given, slightly contrary to what is actually happening in the world.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Exactly. That's why we have so much problems.
Right. But then, is it correct to say that you should not have a competitive spirit?
We should be competing against ourselves, yes. Why?
Because today's culture, if you see really, is to win and not to lose.
Right.
To win and not to lose.
And what happens?
You see the happening around you, the entire corporate world, today call themselves world class and, you know, getting the market share and all that kind
of thing. Sure.
And striving to get that.
Sure.
So unless you have that kind of an aim, you will not have the competitive spirit.
Correct.
You will not be able to compete.
Correct in that sense, yes.
You are a non-performer.
No. Well, of course, in the eyes of others, if you're not making more money, then you're not competitive, absolutely.
So isn't that idea going against what is being said here?
Exactly. That's why, exactly. So, exactly the point.
Okay, then which idea is to be adopted?
Well, we have to look at that ourselves and see which one is going to be the better idea for us. Are we going to be more happy doing that? Are we going to have a more meaningful life, more happy life, less suffering doing that, or doing this? This is what we have to look at.
So you can ignore discrimination.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And what this is saying is that if we adopt that approach, we're going to have all sorts of problems in our life. Okay, maybe if we do that approach, we may end up getting more material wealth, but is that really the source of happiness, this material wealth? And if we adopt that approach, maybe we're going to have a lot of enemies, people who don't like us, maybe we're going to have a lot of jealousy, arrogance towards others, maybe we're not going to have very many close friends, although of course if we accumulate a lot of wealth, a lot of friends will come out of the woodwork, but of course if we lose that money, all these supposed friends seem to disappear very quickly if we don't have any wealth. So this is what we have to look at, you know, which approach is really going to be more meaningful in our life. And often when people look at this, they think, well, if I don't do that approach, if I try to do this, I'm going to become destitute, I'm not going to be able to survive in this rat race here. I think this is not true. This is not true. That we can actually have a very meaningful life, successful life in this life, adopting this strategy. But again, this is something we have to investigate and see what we think will work. You know, that's why, you know, as the Buddha himself said, you know, please merely don't accept what I tell you out of devotion to me. You need to be like a goldsmith that checks and tests the quality of the gold before accepting it. So likewise, this is what is being recommended here, but we have to check this out and see whether this makes sense to us.
What about the idea to try to achieve a position of wealth, fame, and power, with the idea to do so to be able to benefit others more?
Of course. But that's okay, but if the basis of that is unethical lifestyle, then, you know, we can't say that the ends justifies the means. We can't say, but I'm making a lot of money because I want to help people, so it's okay for me to cheat people to get that money because I want to help people. You know, this approach is a little bit contradictory.
Yeah, self-contradictory, because like you said, it's not I don't see the way to get to this point of power, weight, fame, and wealth without living an unethical lifestyle.
I mean, no, I don't agree. I mean, you know, for example, I mean, I think someone like Dalai Lama has a lot of fame and positive influence. Has he had to have an unethical lifestyle to get to that position? No.
But he didn't strive to get into this position.
Exactly. So that's the point, is that he wasn't striving to be famous. But because of following this approach, people look up to him and respect him and look to him for advice and guidance.
Okay, then there's this beautiful saying, give the power to those who don't want it. But the problem is, does you not say,
no,
give the power to those who don't want the power? Anybody who wants power,
oh, okay,
wants motivation, for sure.
Okay, because they want to have power over others.
Even if they say they have good motives. But the problem is, somebody doesn't want the power. He would be qualified to get the power, but he will not get the power.
Well, maybe the Dalai Lama didn't want any power, but does he have power now to influence people? I think he has a lot of power. No? Well, I think there's a lot of other examples, maybe not to that level, but I mean, I think if you look at any of the more highly regarded spiritual practitioners, they're all in the same boat. They're not looking for power, but because of their practice, people look up to them and respect them, and when they say something, people listen to that. But they don't want the power.
Just thinking if I can kind of do the second
example. That I'm loving, caring, and desire to help others and accept this power. Do you have to?
Yeah.
If you want it, it's just the Dalai Lama's a perfect example. If you don't use the power for the right reasons,
yeah.
There's so many people in the
power. Yeah. No, I think there's... I mean, that's the one obvious one, of course. I think there are many other that maybe are not so obvious.
Speaking of the points that Phil raised about competitiveness being necessary to survive in the world like today, there's a movie, Hindi, called Three Idiots.
Three Idiots, yeah. No.
He ends up becoming an inventor, living in Ladakh, helping children, and all kinds of things. And this other man who's only concerned about winning, and cheats, and stuff, all kinds of nasty things. And all he ends up with is a house in America with a wife.
Okay, let's move to the next point, and then we'll take a morning tea break. It says here, do not abuse this practice as a right. So here it says, this also, the commentary is a little bit not so clear, so I'll read again from the other Practice of Lojong book. There is no qualitative difference between someone who, seeking well-being in the long term, except certain loss in the interim, and someone who engages in mind training as a ritual with the long-term motivation to conquer demonic harms. Therefore, avoid behavior such as this that fails to root out the jaundice of self-centeredness from its depth. Some practitioners seem to think that mind training practice is beneficial for such a result or purpose. If this is true, there is no real difference between practicing mind training and engaging in shamanistic rites. To be called Dharma practice, mind training must be an antidote to afflictions and false conceptualization. I think the gist of this, do not abuse this practice as a right, is to not to use this mind training practice for a wrong reason. You know, and like a sort of an example, sometimes people use these sorts of practices to then, they use these practices to, again, to become famous or to make a lot of money or whatever purpose. So to read a little bit on that, I'll just read from here again. page 191. So again, the purpose of Lojong practice, as it said, is it's an antidote to the afflictions and false conceptualizations. So the motivation for doing Lojong practice is to overcome self-grasping, self-cherishing, the mental afflictions. So not to use it for some other inappropriate reason, worldly reason. This slogan, this slogan is about the need for sincerity and honesty in our spiritual pursuits. We should never use spiritual activities to further our dubious and self-centered motivations and goals. We may be doing all the right things in our Lojong practice externally, helping somebody in need, showing loving kindness to others, or lending an ear to the tormented. But our actions lack real sincerity because we are trying to manipulate a situation to our own advantage so that we don't have to relinquish our egoistic domain. So some motivation of trickery is involved here because we are trying to shortchange something or someone. The basis of this slogan relates to quasi-shamanistic practices or making offerings to spirits in order to procure some sort of favor. Trying to coerce spiritual results from a half-hearted demonstration of our practice is like adopting a trader's mentality to spirituality. We'll never obtain results if we covet other people's praise or admiration and let that motivate our actions. Behaving in this way is very protective and defensive as far as our ego is concerned. We shouldn't expect other people to acknowledge what we do or to feel gratitude or indebtedness towards us if we do something beneficial. Other people's recognition is of no concern to ours. This Lojong commitment is simply about doing everything we undertake as thoroughly as possible, without sloppiness or expectations of receiving anything in return. The Kadampa tradition is constantly reiterating that sloppiness is a sign of ignorance and should be countered with mindfulness and awareness at all times. Okay. I think that makes it a little bit more clear what's being said here. So on that note, it's time for morning tea break, so let's have a tea break and come back, and then we've got two more slogans in this sixth point, and then we'll start the seventh point in the next session.